WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The long and mutually beneficial relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia has been a marriage of necessity, wrought with complications and at times with disagreements, but always bubbling with oil and soaked in cash. Now the quarreling lovers may be moving to separate bedrooms. Allegations of a secret oil deal between the Bush White House and the Saudi government, as well as a deadly suicide bombing at the General Security Headquarters in Riyadh, have raised the temperature of an already heated relationship. Tonight on Point, the dysfunctional, codependent, and crucial marriage between the United States and Saudi Arabia. We begin in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Khalid Al-Mayina is the editor-in-chief of Arab News, Saudi Arabia's first English-language newspaper. I asked him to explain the significance of the location of yesterday's bombings in Riyadh. Was this like blowing up the FBI headquarters in Washington?
Well, yes, this was a security forces' old office. It had the police department and the traffic department, so it was not the main headquarters of the security forces, but the impact was great because it happened in the afternoon as people were going to work or coming from work, and it affected a lot of people in that area. The area is a semi-residential and commercial area, so the impact was great.
Well, and to that point, you might think that Muslims would be outraged at Al-Qaeda because of all of the innocent Muslims who are also dying and being injured in these attacks. But I understand that right after the bombings, two journalists were beaten up, one from the West, one from Egypt. Why would they be targets?
I don't think so. They were beaten up I know of one guy from the New York Times, I think, who told me that they put him aside. I think, actually, when the police were investigating in the aftermath of the bombing, but I don't think so, the journalists were beaten by police. And it has nothing to do with Muslims, because terrorism has no religion. And let me set the record straight. I mean, people are against Al-Qaeda or any organization that, you know, spews hate and creates this kind of action. So I don't think it was directed against any journalists. Maybe these people were caught in a melee or something.
What's been the reaction where you are to the reports in the new Bob Woodward book about a deal between the Saudi Arabian government and the Bush administration to increase oil production, which would thereby lower oil prices just in time for the election next November?
I had a smug smile. I mean, a lot of people said that, is it possible that Saudi Arabia can have an effect on the American election? I don't know, because Woodward would not write anything that might get him in trouble or a lawsuit. But the Saudis have always been trying to stabilize oil prices for quite some time, because very high oil prices will not be good for us. But then people would be upset if we really bend down towards the Americans. So I think we are just watching and waiting and listening to what the radio and the talk shows in the States. But the reaction has been that, do we have that clout to influence the American election?
So you don't see people being angry so much as bemused?
They are bemused. That's the right word. I think they're bemused. And somebody said, I mean, we are in the superpower league if we can really have that much of an effect on the American elections. But I don't think so. And basically, let me be very frank, people are more concerned with the daily lives. Here they're concerned with what's going on in Iraq, in Palestine. So I think Bob Woodward's book is not of much concern to them.
Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia said in Washington today that it's now all-out war between the government and terrorists. And I wonder, if that's the case, do you have any way of knowing, do we have any way of knowing where public sympathies lie? Is it more for the monarchy and the royal family, or more for some of the goals, if not the organization of Al-Qaeda?
Well, there may be differences between the public and the government, but, I mean, let me be very frank. I think the monarchy is the glue that holds the country together. It's a very large country, almost the size of Europe, different groups, tribal customs and tradition, different cities. And I think the monarchy holds the country, it's the cohesive force. But having said that, I think people's aspirations are changing. 50% of our population is young people. They have different goals. They have different needs. And I think we have to look into those things. We have to look into education, the bureaucracy, other things and all. And I think we have to have a dialogue. And we are on this road. But incidents or like yesterday's sort of affects us. And we hope that it will not deter the powers that be from going ahead with the plans for reforms that will sort of enable us to have empowerment and to play a more decisive role in our own future.
One of Osama bin Laden's demands originally was that the U.S. withdraw from its military bases in Saudi Arabia. That has happened. Why wasn't that enough to calm things down?
Well, I think the Osama bin Laden has his own agenda. He has got so many things up. But Osama bin Laden doesn't speak for the people of Saudi Arabia. I doubt there are people who would support anyone who is on a murderous spree, and I'm not speaking about Osama bin Laden, anyone, even the perpetrators of yesterday's horror act also will not evoke any sympathy. So I really don't know, but the majority of the people of Saudi Arabia are peaceful. And let me tell you one thing, most mothers, if you ask them in Saudi Arabia, would want their children to carry laptops instead of grenades. This is the hard reality that people should know.
So in terms of general mood, not so angry as perhaps we think?
No, they are angry. The people are angry, but not at the government. The people are angry at what's going around them. I mean, they say, you know, with satellites and TVs, they see what's happening in Iraq. They see what's happening in Palestine. Unfortunately, things were made much more murky by the statement of Mr. Bush a few days ago when he met Sharon. I mean, these things are angering people. They've really got people, even the liberals, upset, the seculars upset, the Islamists upset. So this is the reason of their anger. I mean, the blind support for the other side, oblivious to the aspirations of the people, forcing down the democracy that is alien to this way. I'm not saying that democracy itself is alien, but as you say in America, different strokes for different folks. And this is exactly, I think there should be an evolution rather than something forced down our throat.
But if people are angry, as you say, then perhaps we shouldn't be surprised at their response to bombings like this. If they see them as a blow against the West, in other words, and they're angry at the West, then wouldn't think that was okay?
Let me correct it. There is no such thing as West or East. I mean, it is the United States. I mean, when you say West, you lump Europe with it. I mean, we have great contacts with Europe. We have good relations with Britain. France and Germany were against the war. Italy, a million Christians walked in support of the anti-war movement. So I don't think so we should fall in the trap of saying the West. There is resentment against U.S. policies, not the U.S. people. I mean, ask any Saudi, where would you like to study? He would automatically say the United States. What would you like to watch? I would like to watch the Lakers or the Bulls and the, you know, these kind of things. So there is, among the people, there's great affinity with the American people because in many ways we have similarities, but we are really upset at the U.S. policy. But I don't think so that any cause or any upset should can justify killing of people, whether in New York or whether in Riyadh or whether in Madrid or Bali. There's nothing that justifies the killing of people, whatever the anger is.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Khalid Al-Maina is the editor-in-chief of Arab News. He spoke with me from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And we're talking this hour about troubles in the House of Saud and what that means to the United States and to the House of Bush. How important is it that the U.S. maintain a good relationship with Saudi Arabia? Has this marriage of convenience become too inconvenient to continue for both countries? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Youssef Ibrahim. He is the managing director of the Strategic Energy Investment Group and former Middle East correspondent for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Newsweek magazine. Welcome, Youssef.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us. You just heard what Khalid had to say about the bombing and Saudi reaction to it. How does that square with what you're hearing from your sources?
Well, I agree with some of what Khalid is saying, but I think the he under perhaps did not emphasize or wanted to say with some precision the degree to which there is a profound dislike in Saudi Arabia towards the United States, and I'm not surprised at all that an American reporter finds himself at the receiving end of something like that, even as he is coming to document a bombing which victimized many Saudis, albeit Saudis who represent the Saudi security forces. There is anger and confusion in the kingdom like I have never seen it in the 25 years I've been covering it. I visited the kingdom twice in the past 6 months, and I was truly taken aback by the dimension of dislike of this administration. I agree with Khaled that, generally speaking, there is a vast amount of affection for the United States as a culture, as a place to which many Saudis used to like to come, but at the moment many of them are not coming or are being denied visas. The objection to the American policies next door in Iraq and, of course, in Palestine have become paramount at the moment. And I think, as you pointed out in your comments, this is no longer a marriage. It's not quite a divorce, but I'm absolutely sure the strategic alliance that was struck by President Roosevelt and King Saud the Great, in the 40s after World War II, is no longer there.
And what about the Bob Woodward revelations about an oil deal? We heard Khalid say, no big deal. Is that what you're hearing as well?
No, I think it's an extremely big deal. I think it is the talk of Saudi Arabia. I can't even begin to tell you how many telephone calls I've received on that from Saudi Arabia. People are profoundly upset if this is true. And it is possible that it was true. You got to remember, Gail, that he said that Prince Bandar, who is a pillar of the Saudi royal family, not to mention a pillar of the diplomatic community in Washington, D.C., told this to the president in January of 2003. So you could argue that was then and now is now. However, for a senior member of the Saudi royal family to promise this particular administration, the one headed by George W. Bush, who is, without any contest, the most hated American president in the Arab world ever, that he is going to do everything to encourage his re-election, is something that has made the blood of many Saudis, including secular, and I'm sure people like Khalid himself, boil.
So not the bemusement that that he characterized it as. What?
I think Khalid is trying to be diplomatic.
All right. I'm sorry, we're having a little trouble hearing you. Perhaps you...
I know he's trying to be diplomatic, but he's a friend of mine, and I understand that he is a diplomat.
And does it make a difference that he's speaking from Riyadh? I mean, where are the people that you're speaking to? Obviously not to the same audience. They're saying these things privately to you.
Privately, this is what every Saudi is saying. I mean, the Saudis are rolling their eyes over every time Bush makes a pronouncement on Arabs, on Islam, and lately, of course, on Palestine in the deal he gave Prime Minister of Israel, Eric Sharon, in effect giving him the West Bank of the Jordan as a gift. I assure you that the reaction in the Saudi street, and the Saudi street includes the extremists and the followers of bin Laden, which are, by the way, many, many more than we think, and the liberals and those who would naturally and normally gravitate towards the United States.
Well, we're going to take a break. We'll be exploring those issues when we come back. We're talking this hour about Saudi Arabia and the United States, about a marriage of convenience that seems to be becoming less convenient for both countries. Can the monarchy survive with or without the U.S.? If the Saudi government fell, what do you think might take its place? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the dysfunctional but crucially important relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States, and the long and profitable relationship between the House of Saud and the House of Bush. Do these two families, these two countries, need each other more than ever? And if the Saudi government fell, what might take its place? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Youssef Ibrahim, Managing Director of the Strategic Energy Investment Group and former Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. And also joining us is Craig Unger, author of House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties. Welcome to you, Craig.
Good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and now I'm going to give you an impossible assignment, and that is you trace the relationship between the Bushes and the Saudis in great detail in your book. So can you summarize 281 pages briefly for us? Just give us some broad outlines of that relationship and how it's evolved over time.
Well, it's an extraordinary relationship, and I believe never before in the history of the White House as a president been so close to another foreign power as both Bushes really have been to the Saudis, both George Bushes. And it goes back well over 20 years, and I traced, to put it in financial terms, I traced $1.4 billion in investments and contracts that went from the House of Saud into companies in which the Bushes and their allies have had major positions. I'm talking about companies like Harkin Energy, where George W. Bush was a member of the board of directors, Halliburton with Dick Cheney, of course, and the Carlyle Group, where Bush Sr. has been a senior advisor, and James Baker has been a partner as well. So, and it goes in the public sector, the private sector. There's a great personal relationship between Prince Bandar and Bush Sr. And if you look at the body language of Prince Bandar when he's visiting George W. Bush, this is not a guy standing in awe of the President of the United States. This is a man who's visiting his good friend's son. He's sort of lying across a club chair very, very casually, very, very relaxed. He visits Kenneth Bunkport in Crawford, Texas, and he has just unfettered access. In a way, he's been compared to Colin Powell said he was like a cabinet member of the United States government, except he does not have congressional oversight.
Now, obviously, $1.4 billion is a pretty staggering number. How'd you come up with that?
Well, essentially, these are at the biggest part of it really comes from the Carlyle Group. And there, Bush Sr. and James Baker would go to Saudi Arabia and raise money from the royal family, raise investment capital, and they raised about $80 million. In addition, while they were at Carlyle, they acquired a number of defense companies that did business with Saudi Arabia. Halliburton got about $140 million in contracts. One of the most interesting things, though, was in the 80s with Harkin Energy was a struggling small oil company in Texas drilling one dry well after another. It was at a time when the price of oil was plummeting, and suddenly who came? It was 3 days away from bankruptcy, and suddenly who came to its rescue but several Saudis and bailed it out. And the Saudis really don't need a struggling oil company in Texas. I think what they were looking for really was someone on the board of directors named George W. Bush, whose father at the time was President of the United States. And it shows the way they've tried to acquire access to political power. I should add, by the way, that they've gone after Democrats as well. And if you go back to the 70s, you may remember Burt Lance and Clark Clifford, whose careers were certainly tarnished by their relationship with Saudis through BCCI.
But if U.S. policy stayed basically the same during the Clinton years between Bush 1 and Bush 2, doesn't that challenge your premise that there was something special about the Bushes?
Well, I'm not sure that it was exactly the same, and I think there have been favors going back and forth. And the current revelation by Bob Woodward it really is quite extraordinary when you think about it. The bottom line is the United States needs Saudi oil, and it's not surprising that a president of the United States would ask for the Saudis to lower oil prices. One would expect that. What is interesting is that through that personal relationship, the Saudis are in a position to do it and do it in a manner in which the timing could actually influence a presidential election. And I think from both the American point of view and the Saudi point of view, it's quite extraordinary. In addition, if you look at the war on terror, the Clintons really tried to put pressure on the Saudis through the banking system to trace funds, through the FBI to trace terrorist bombings in 95 and 96 at Khobar Towers. They had a very mixed success, it's true, and they ran into resistance from the Saudis, as well as internal political problems in the United States because of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But the Bushes really relaxed things enormously. They started a program called Visa Express, which allowed Saudis to get a visa to the United States without even having to go to the consulate. And three of the hijackers for 9/11 took advantage of this program, by the way. It was so convenient. And then, of course, afterwards, after 9/11, you have the Bandar lobbied for and seemed to get a lot of Saudis to fly out of the country at a time, beginning at a time in which there were still restrictions in American airspace.
Youssef, I want to go back to you for a moment because I understand that you were in Iran when the Shah was overthrown there. And
yeah.
What you're hearing is some pretty damning information on top of Saudi public opinion being pretty angry at the United States to begin with. Do you see some of the same conditions prevailing that could make something like that possible?
Again, what I see is a total awareness by the Saudi royal family of exactly the experience I documented as bureau chief of the New York Times during the fall of the Shah. They realized that you cannot place too much of a distance between you and your population, especially when you have a full-fledged Islamic extremist insurrections on your hands with people blowing up buildings in the middle of the capital. So I think everything that Craig said is correct, but it reflects the past, not the present. And it reflects a deeply ingrained Bedouin tradition, and of course Saudi Arabia is essentially Bedouin society, of extreme loyalty to a friend who stood by you. That man was called George W. Bush Sr., or Bush 41. It does not and has not transferred to George Jr. They did a lot of favors to George Bush Jr.'s which were just mentioned for his father, as they say in the movie The Godfather, but not for him. And I think you will find that promise that Prince Bandar made to the president is not going to be cashable in the bank. I don't think when the time comes, the Saudis will help George Bush win the election by lowering oil prices. I mean, market forces may lower oil prices, but I don't think a deliberate Saudi action will be there because the Saudis are taking tremendous offense at the policies of George Bush. And in fact, the Crown Prince does not share those sentiments, and he's been known to use very unflattering terms in referring to the president.
I want to get back to something we were talking about before we took the break, and that was about public opinion about these bombings in particular, because we did hear today from Saudi Arabia's top cleric that he said the people behind the car bombing in Riyadh would burn in hell for killing innocent Muslims. So apparently the U.S. is not the only focus of people's anger. But what about public support for the militants? I mean, they're not being turned in, but do we know that they're being supported? You mentioned that you thought there was a fair amount of public support for al-Qaeda.
Yes. All these people are the products of an ingrained, deeply ingrained, fundamentalist religious establishment that's like an octopus. It has its tentacles in every facet of Saudi life, from education to what you show on television to what you print in newspaper. Do you remember our friend Gamal Khashoggi, who was fired as editor-in-chief of Al Watan for advocating the disbandment of the religious police? Now he was fired because the religious establishment went to the Crown Prince and said, we cannot tolerate anybody who says this in a newspaper, and he was fired. He is now advisor to Prince Turki, the ambassador of Saudi Arabia in London. So do not underestimate the power of the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia. And what I would fault the Saudi rulers for at the moment is that while they're taking on the guys with the guns, the guys who are planting bombs here and there, they're not taking on the political commissars, the ideologues who have grown them, who continue to nurture them, and who continue to create hundreds like them in schools and in religious education. This is where the real cancer in Saudi Arabia lies, and this is where the real confrontation in Saudi Arabia must go.
All right, let's bring one of our listeners into the conversation now from Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Fred's on the line. Hello, Fred, and welcome.
Thank you. My thoughts about Saudi Arabia are is that it's tragically flawed and has been so for some time, that the House of Saud is inherently a hypocritical house, that they have their palaces and they live a very high life, but it's an extremely conservative country. And instead of from years ago having the vision to perceive of the leadership opportunity that was presented by Sadat to enter into agreements with Israel that would have benefited the Palestinian and others, they were part of the refusenik group, refused to recognize them, refused to deal with them. In addition, they always compromise their principles, and they believe that by paying and supporting, and many in the House of Saud directly paid for bin Laden's al-Qaeda, and we've seen pictures of some of them laughing after 9/11 at the destruction of the World Trade Centers, that they still lack the courage and the vision to move not only the Saudi Arabians ahead, but the rest of the Arab world, to really negotiate directly with Israel and to encourage others to come to an agreement which would benefit the rest of the Arab world. I think what's happened is that Israel has conveniently, since its creation, been the boogeyman to avoid attention at the failure to develop the sciences, the arts, and education. Rather than that, as the last person who spoke said, they have sold their soul to the ideologues who control the education in Saudi Arabia.
Fred, I want to throw that point to thanks for the call, and I want to throw that to Craig, because you actually make the point in your book that the Saudis were already married to someone else, and that was Islamic fundamentalism. So that meant that the U.S. then had to look the other way. And I wonder if you'd expand on that and also speak to Fred's point.
Right. Well, it's really hard for them to crack down on Islamic fundamentalism, on the extremists, because a large part of it is part of the government. There's no separation between church and state. You have, as you said, pointed out, a religious police, and they have just enormous power. If there were a separation between church and state, I think you'd have a very different situation. But since there is none, there's sort of a spectrum of complicity among many of the rulers of Saudi Arabia. And I think we see a very, very different side when they come to the United States. We see the very Western side of Prince Bandar on the sidelines at Dallas Cowboy football games and so on. But it's a very, very different world in Saudi Arabia.
Let's go to Dave now. He's on the line from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hello, Dave. Thanks for joining us.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I was just going to address the point about the royal family, if they're going to fall or they're going to stay in power. First of all, United States is not going to allow that to happen, for Saudi Arabia to fall, because they need it. You know, they need the oil, they need the thing. And the other thing, they're afraid that if the Saudi Arabia fail, you know, the royal family goes down, that the Islamists will take over. That's not going to happen. The Islamists are not going to take over, because there is a lot of opposition live in Europe, and those people, they are more educated, more than anything. But United States, the United States purposely, they supported the royal family in Saudi Arabia in the whole Gulf, because there's where the money is. Because without allowing the Saudis, those people, to be more educated, more anything, that it's like it's not, you know, it's easy for the United States to control the whole region over there because of the oil. I mean, that's because they need the oil. First of all, that when the Saudi Arabia, when they came to power a long time ago, they make a deal between the Wahhabism and themselves. They said to that, and that's when the British was controlling the area, and they make a deal between Saudi, the Al Saud family and the Wahhabism movement in that time to to tell them, we rule the country and you control the daily activities of the people or religion, I think. And they pump a lot. And the Wahhabi movement, actually what happened, they have a ministry. They call it the religion ministry. And the Saudi pumps all the money to them. And everybody there in this ministry have, you know, nice money, nice paid, and everybody willing, you know, to go there. That's how, you know, what I'm saying?
Gotcha, Dave. Gotcha, Dave. Thanks, and I appreciate the point. And that is an interesting question, Youssef, because, you know, how can the Saudis crack down on the Wahhabists? Is that even possible? Because, you know, they might not endorse their methods, but on some level they might agree with some of their goals.
It is difficult, and what we are witnessing now shows you how difficult it is. Al-Qaeda, which reflects the Wahhabist thinking, which in turn reflects, don't let us not kid ourselves, half the Saudi population, which is called the Najd people. You know, Saudi Arabia is referred to as the people of Najd and the people of the Hejaz. The people of the Hejaz are the people who live along the Red Sea coast and the Persian Gulf coast. They've been trading with the world for centuries. They're more open-minded. They're more liberals. These are what we refer to as the liberals. But in deep in the Saudi desert, where most of the Saudi establishment comes from, it's a very closed society, very religious society, very Wahhabist society, which believes profoundly and gives the highest respect to its religious leaders. Now, something interesting, Gil, that people don't know, King Faisal, who was killed by a nephew who was a fundamentalist, over the introduction of television into the kingdom, did not accept a religious figure to sit in his council, in his majlis, the equivalent of a salon, which all Saudi leaders hold weekly. It was after King Faisal's death that the religious figures began to surface in the royal entourage, and since then, I would argue, they actually gained most of their power, because with the oil money coming in, they rode on top of that to spread the Wahhabi message, not only in Saudi Arabia, but throughout the Arab world and throughout the Muslim world. And that's when we had the massive projection of all of this into Afghanistan and Indonesia and Pakistan, et cetera, et cetera. So you are talking about a big 900-pound gorilla here. And furthermore, what is happening now is Al-Qaeda has decided to actually launch an active war against the Saudi regime, which is what we are seeing with all these bombings in the streets every day.
We're going to take a break and then we'll continue. We're discussing this hour the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, a marriage of necessity that is causing problems these days for both governments. How important is it that the U.S. maintain a good relationship with Saudi Arabia? And if the Saudi government fell, what do you think would take its place? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the turbulent and lucrative relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and also about the deep and controversial relationship between the Bush family and Saudi Arabia's royal family. What did you make of Bob Woodward's story promising more oil production to keep prices low leading up to the election? Do these two families, these two countries, need each other now more than ever? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Craig Unger, author of House of Bush, House of Saud, The Secret Relationship Between the World's Two Most Powerful Dynasties, and also with Youssef Ibrahim, former New York Times Middle East correspondent and managing editor of the Strategic Energy Investment Group. And Craig, I want to explore this notion of the fault lines that seem to be appearing literally and figuratively between the administration and the monarchy. For example, when Colin Powell was there in March, he was publicly critical of the Saudis for arresting reformers. But do you see whether the reformers have enough support to become real players if the monarchy were to go away, or would they be shoved aside by the fundamentalists?
It's really hard to say. I think Saudi Arabia is under assault from two fronts, and it's both the militant clergy and the reformers, and it's constantly shifting. They can't accommodate one without alienating the other. At the same time, I think the relationship with the United States is dicier than ever. And as if Youssef pointed out, they've been very, very unhappy with Bush 43. Even before 9/11 happened, Crown Prince Abdullah was furious at the United States, and this was in the summer of 2001, was ready to send Prince Bandar in with a message to Bush 40, the current president, to say, listen, you're from Uruguay, this is over, this is almost over. He called Bush 43 to try to get the son, the current president, to change his policy. So it's a very, very volatile relationship, and yet they both need each other more than ever.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. To Milwaukee, Wisconsin now, Abu is on the line. Hello, Abu.
Hello there. I would like to make some connection between the ideals of going to war against Iraq that are stated by the Bush administration being going against to get rid of a tyrant, Saddam Hussein. And at the same time, we know that there's a big tyrant in Saudi Arabia. People are not allowed to speak their voice. Anybody who is objecting the state and the government, he can have his head decapitated easily with no due trial. So he's a tyrant. The regime there is a tyrant by definition, and there is way more other tyrants in the area and the world that are big allies of the United States. Example, Islam Karimov, who boiled and put HIV serum, and the people were objecting him, and he's a major ally of the United States. So then my question is that how does it make sense to the people of the United States? On one side, we are losing hundreds of thousands of lives to get rid of a tyrant, yet we are siding a lot of tyrants across the world. That's one of my questions. My comment and my envision is that the Muslim world is going to be united under one state that is called Al-Khilafah, the Khilafah state, which is the universal Islamic state that will redo the whole map of the Muslim world and will tell the United States, thanks, but no thanks. We need nobody to police us. We can protect ourselves. Khilafah is the way that is going to get rid of the Saudi regime and all the regimes, including Israel.
Thanks for the call, Abu. Let's put that question to Youssef.
Well, that's another radical fundamentalist Islamist for you. Khilafah is, in fact, part of the movement of radical Muslim fundamentalists. As a matter of fact, if the Saudi family were to fall today, to answer your previous question, the so-called liberals, or as Craig called them, reformists, simply do not have the political infrastructure to fill the void. The people who have the infrastructure are, in fact, the religious establishment that has been feeding Muslim extremists. And that establishment, very simply, is the mosques. You cannot have political parties in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt or in the Arab world or in Pakistan or, you know, in any number of, in Kazakhstan or any number of dictatorships around the world. And when you do that, the only void you leave, if it's a Muslim country or a Christian or a Jewish country for that matter, is either the synagogue, the church, or the mosque, and hence begins the embryo of fundamentalism of any kind. I mean, separation of church and state, the moment you don't have that, and you don't have in the same time political liberty or a liberal society, it's a license for extremists, religious extremists, to impose their religion as a political agenda, which is exactly what we are seeing there. Now, do I believe that the Saudi royal family is about to fall? It's a bit too early to make that prediction. Is it under exceeding strain? Yes. But, Gail, if I may just think a little bit outside the box, the Saudi traditional relationship with America is ending, and the oil relationship is also ending. The Saudis, like any energy experts in the world will tell you, are completely aware that in 5 years, China will take the place of the United States as the world's largest oil consumer. In fact, today, 90% of the Persian Gulf oil is going to Asia. Only 10% is coming to America, which explains why suddenly we find Colonel Muammar Gaddafi so sympathetic, because he happens to be on the Mediterranean and he has a lot of oil, even though he's a bloody murderer who ordered the killing of 280 Americans on Pan Am 103. So oil plays a big role here, but oil also will play a big role in the divorce between America and Saudi Arabia.
So you're saying that absent oil, the relationship would no longer be important? I mean, aren't there other strategic reasons?
Oil is an absolute pillar in this relationship. The original deal between King Saud and Roosevelt was, you guarantee us cheap oil to feed our economies. We built the American economy on cheap oil, for God's sakes. I mean, all these cars coming out of the Ford assembly line, all the fridges, all the appliances, et cetera, was built on cheap oil, and we will give you security. Now, that pact is breaking down now, because the biggest threat to Saudi Arabia recently was Iran and Iraq. Iran has made its deal with the Saudis. Iraq is occupied by the Americans, and the Americans are bogged down in Iraq and cannot attack anybody else at the moment. They certainly cannot occupy Saudi oil fields and keep them. Therefore, there is new thinking in Saudi Arabia. Why not look at China? Why not look at the Western European Union? Why not look at the euro instead of the dollar?
Well, it does raise an interesting point. If the government were to fall, whether the United States could do anything about it, presuming it wanted to, because, as you say, so many troops are tied up in Iraq.
Iraq has ended the whole neoconservative talk about regime changes. You think the Syrians and the Iranians are afraid of the United States now? They're no longer afraid. Are we talking about regime changes anymore? We're not saying that word anymore. In fact, I was in Iran about 3 months ago, and I met with some of the so-called hardliner, and their view of the situation is not, it's not the United States who's surrounding us, whose troops in Kuwait and Iraq and Uzbekistan. We are surrounding the United States with our Shiites inside Iraq. And therefore, the notion that there is a danger which must be prevented by the United States and Saudi Arabia no longer holds. And a lot of people are saying, why don't we disengage? Why don't we look at the Europeans? Why don't we look at China? These are our economic partners of the future.
Craig, can I ask you for a real quick last word here?
Well, I think Youssef is exactly right. And you recently had the dissolution of a $25 billion pipeline that James Baker had been hoping to put together with Saudi Arabia, and now they're looking to China, Russia, and as potential partners. The future looks really grim in many ways, because we are still very oil dependent, and we have not found a replacement for Saudi oil. And there, as Youssef points out, there's going to be enormous competition for that in the future, in addition to which you have a sort of a teetering Saudi regime. And if there are changes in that regime, whoever replaces, even if it's within the current House of Saud, whoever may replace the current rulers is likely to be more anti-American, not more pro-American.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Craig Unger, Youssef Ibrahim, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
To continue the conversation online, go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, an Earth Day plea by Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist E.O. Wilson. This is On Point. Americans across the country are celebrating the 34th annual Earth Day today. Presidential rivals George W. Bush and John Kerry marked the day by sparring over the environment. At a nature reserve in Maine, President Bush touted his environmental record and announced a plan to increase the size of protected U.S. wetlands. While in Houston, Senator Kerry blasted Bush, saying the president, quote, has put the brakes on 30 years of environmental progress. Tonight, in honor of Earth Day, we bring you an excerpt from a speech by Pulitzer Prize-winning Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson. Speaking earlier this week, Wilson pleaded for the world to start taking environmental problems seriously, or, he said, it will face the possibility of a major loss in the diversity of life on Earth.
John Sawhill, the late president of the Nature Conservancy, encapsulated the central concept of the conservation ethic for us all when he said, a society is defined not just by what it creates, but by what it refuses to destroy. And it's true. In the rush of this new century, with our attention so fully captured by politics and religion, the economy and entertainment, and all thought about on the short term, we might pause just a moment to ask ourselves, what have we overlooked about our place in history? What is civilization destroying and losing forever? The answer, I believe, and ask you to consider, is much of the rest of life on this planet, composing humanity's natural heritage, or, if you prefer, the creation with a capital C. Our relation to the rest of life in 2004 can be put in a nutshell as follows. First, in the past several decades, researchers have found the biosphere to be far richer in diversity than ever before imagined. Most of it is still unexplored and unknown. Among the species of plants, animals, and microorganisms already known and given a scientific name, the vast majority of those remain unstudied in any other way. Second, biodiversity, comprising ecosystems, species, and genes, which took over 3.5 billion years to evolve, is being eroded at an accelerating rate by human activity. And finally, that loss is going to inflict a heavy price in wealth, security, especially environmental security, and in spirit. This is among the reasons that altogether the 21st century, in my opinion, is destined to be called the century of the environment, not the century of democratization, as important as that is, not the 100 years war against terrorism, as necessary as that may prove to be, not the age of space colonization, we can all dream, can't we, but the century of the environment. It will be seen as a time that either we put this house in order, planet Earth, and settle down before we wreck the planet or suffer the consequences. I believe we will settle down because, as Abba Ibon once said memorably during the 1967 war, when all else fails, men turn to reason. The future is usefully conceived as a bottleneck of a continuing rise in population and per capita consumption, leading to further environmental decline in most parts of the world. Science and technology, combined with lack of self-understanding and a Stone Age obstinacy that led to our ruinous environmental practices, have brought us to where we are today. Now science and technology, combined with a foresight hitherto unpracticed, a more enlightened ethic, and moral courage has to see us through that bottleneck and out, one hopes, by the end of the century.
Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist Edward O. Wilson speaking earlier this week at the National Press Club in recognition of Earth Day. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.